page and say, okay, we are in this big crisis, but now we're going to turn the page. And we...
Wendy?
Yes, Lisa.
Is the water warm enough?
Yes, Lisa.
Shall we begin?
Hi, this is Mark Ruffalo, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
W.S. Graves, crashing into me, G stands for green, and Columbia County, X marks the spot, a dial to me, creating a new dimension, WGXC.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Ben Enziga of Hudson, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hi, everyone. It's Lily, the youth peer leader from Mental Health Association of Columbia Green County's Clubhouse. Are you a teen wanting to learn more about health education? Maybe you're looking to complete your volunteer hours or in need of a job. The weekly teen clinic on Wednesdays from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Family Planning, located on the third floor of the county building on Main Street in Catskill, can help you answer any of your questions. Information can be found at greengovernment.com. Hope to see you there.
Description.
The most extraordinary output ever to emerge from the motion picture studio.
It cost $4 million and it has 4 million thrills.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Voting proof of citizenship efforts are afoot in Michigan, while voters await the outcome of the Federal SAVE Act and a Trump executive order requiring similar restrictions. This despite no evidence of widespread non-citizen voting in Michigan or anywhere else in the U.S. In Michigan, a constitutional amendment which failed to achieve a two-thirds majority in the legislature just received the go-ahead to collect signatures for a citizen ballot initiative instead. If organizers meet the signature requirements, it could appear on the 2026 ballot. The Michigan proposal requires any new registering voters to show, quote, a birth certificate, passport, and/or other documents, and would eliminate the use of sworn affidavits for voters without approved IDs. Voters without citizenship documents could cast a provisional ballot, but must return with the documents within 6 days for it to count. While that may keep the 20, that's 2-0, alleged Michigan non-citizens from voting, 1 in 9 Americans don't have ready access to citizenship documents, and over 5.8 million Michigan citizens don't own a U.S. passport, according to the Center for American Progress. On the national proof of citizenship front, a federal circuit court ruling on President Donald Trump's March 25th order is expected April 24th, and the SAVE Act is in the U.S. Senate, but unlikely to overcome the filibuster. We have links to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Let's go for a walk. Don't talk. Try to be a deeper listener.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We are not going to tolerate individuals who leak to the mainstream media. The Secretary of Defense is doing a tremendous job, and he is bringing monumental change to the Pentagon. We've seen a smear campaign since the moment that President Trump announced his nomination before the United States Senate. Let me reiterate, the president stands strongly behind Secretary Hegseth.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says President Donald Trump is standing behind Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, in spite of reports he's looking for a replacement. Hegseth used a public texting app to discuss sensitive military plans with his wife, brother, and personal lawyer. Secretary of the State Marco Rubio has announced a major overhaul of the State Department, cutting staff by 15% and consolidating over 100 bureaus. The administration has separately announced plans to scale back the agency's diversity, inclusion, and women's programs while slashing foreign aid. A federal judge is indefinitely pausing White House moves to dismantle U.S.-funded international broadcasters, including Voice of America and Radio Free Asia. The ruling mandates the reinstatement of staff and contractors. Trump will attend the funeral of Pope Francis Saturday in Rome. The first pontiff from the Global South will be remembered for advocacy on behalf of the environment, refugees, and victims of conflict. Columbia graduate, Palestinian activist, and legal Vermont resident Mohsen Mahdawi says he still believes in American democracy in spite of being arrested at a routine immigration meeting.
I'm staying positive by reassuring myself in the inevitability of justice and in the deep belief of democracy. This is the reason I wanted to become a citizen of this country, because I believe in the principles of this country.
Vermont Democratic Senator Peter Welch says he hopes to have Mahdawi released. Meanwhile, hundreds of international students studying in Texas are suing to stay in the country after losing their visas. A South Dakota bus tour hopes to call attention to the impact of federal funding freezes on farms, rural health care, and small communities. Madison Mayor Roy Lindsay says they're afraid of losing a pipeline project aimed at improving water quality.
It seemed like, you know, whoever's pushing the buttons are looking at numbers more than, you know, reality of what those departments actually mean.
Southern farmers say they just hope to survive low prices for commodities like soybeans and chaos in agriculture export markets. Mississippi State Extension Specialist Justin Calhoun is also a farmer.
We're in survival mode. Cut back in every way that we can. Try to make sure that, number one, we're sustaining our yield potential, but cut back on the extra unnecessary expenses just to try to make it through to next year.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Learning a new trade and being the new person on a job site can be hard, especially if there's nobody else there who looks like you. Native American women working in solar may know the feeling well.
They might be the only woman, they might be the only brown person in their group of installers that they'll be working with.
Alicia Hayden is with Red Cloud Renewable, a Native-led nonprofit based in South Dakota. The group runs free solar workforce training programs, including one specifically for Native American women. For graduate Jacinta Goggles, learning alongside other Native women created camaraderie.
There's a certain kinship you feel, and I think that ability to be so comfortable with each other very quickly was a huge factor in all of our success, because all of us wanted each other to succeed.
And Hayden says participants leave the program connected with other participants and with mentors already working in the field.
In their cell phone, they have the names of 15 new friends they just made, some of which are Native American women who have been working in this industry for 10 years that are just a phone call or a text away.
So even if they're the only Native woman on a job site, they can feel supported, connected, and less alone. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A radio network, an empire upon an empire.
I make no promises.
You on the mark.
With one purpose only, to point out and make public the dishonesty. Now in complete control of the government of this state.
There's only one man who can rid the politics of this state of the evil domination.
Hello.
Funny how forever seems not long enough, yet Hello, this is Matthew Tombers, and you're listening to WGXC, Acre, Catskill, Hudson.
Welcome to New American Radio, a series exploring new territories for the art of radio.
In its 10 years as a weekly national series from 1987 to 1998, New American Radio commissioned and distributed over 300 original works. Conceptual new drama, associational documentary, language explorations, sonic meditations, environmental compositions, musical explorations, and works that pioneer new dimensions in acoustic space. Wave Farm is thrilled to partner with New American Radio to ensure these works remain available to listeners today and into the future. New American Radio was organized by Helen Thorrington, executive producer, and Regina Beyer, associate producer. A special thanks to both Helen Thorrington and Joanne Green for their generous support and collaboration in this partnership. Up next is O Little Town of East New York by Shelley Hirsch. Thank you for listening.
Jaime and Harry are the fruit man and the butcher, respectively. And they have a little store together over there on Pitkin Avenue. I go there to buy things. There's a bakery, too. You can get a little cornbread. I take out the middle slice because it's so good to eat it. And then you stick it together and no one knows what you've done. Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. Jessie Raskin's house always has the smell of chicken soup. Her mother's always boiling it. They had it every Friday. Boiled chicken. Yick. And you know what? When Kennedy was being assassinated on TV, Joycey was over there in the bathtub having her pimples picked. I had ringlets in my hair. My mother used to comb my hair and make these big banana curls. That's what I was doing, waiting for them to dry when Kennedy died. Joycey and her family lived in apartment 3E at 544 Hemlock Street. I moved there when I was 3 years old. 544 Hemlock Street. Four floors and we moved to the top. And there were four kids in my family and we had four rooms. The kitchen had copper and turquoise stenciled walls and there were two bedrooms. One of them was painted coral and the other lilac. In the living room, there was a window that looked out onto the courtyard, and you would wave across the way to the people that lived on the other side, and we shared a clothesline. And sometimes we'd put on shows in the courtyard. There were no trees or anything, so, like, it was easy. The people in the houses above had a really good view. Johnny Wilson lived there, and he had big muscles on his arms. He was a policeman, and he and his wife Dottie would invite us over at Christmas time. And Dad would dress up as Santa Claus and going around to everyone's apartment telling his version of how Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer got his shiny nose. All different kinds of music coming out of everyone's apartment and seeping into the hallway. George Rifkin used to sit behind his doorway playing his trap set. He had a little goatee and he looked a lot like Mitch Miller. And he had a wife named Ray Rifkin who had peroxided blonde hair. The women would go around to each other's apartment every week playing mahjong games. And Mom wore the best Chinese lounging pajamas. The Dinnersteins, the Donnellys, the Wilsons, the Rizzos, the Carnegies, Claire Freed and Sippy Freed and Rhonda, all mingling in the hallways at 544 Hemlock Street with its tiled floors and the wooden banisters that us kids used to slide down and all the marble, the hallways, just like some kind of city cavern. The way it echoed and everything.
Life to
Olga lived by Highland Park with her Russian father, Vasily, and his mother, Nunu, who she shared a room with. Nunu was over 70 years old and didn't speak a word of English. She was always stirring a big pot of borscht on the stove. Their bedroom had little watercolors that Maria had painted, tastefully placed on the walls, and light was always streaming in through the windows. I'd go over there with my long, silky dresses, and Maria would play Russian music on the phonograph, and I'd dance over the ottomans, and she'd sketch. Her mother, who didn't live with them, was Austrian, and she would come to visit Maria on weekends, and they'd take walks in the park and talk about clouds. Imagine talking about clouds with your mother. Her father seemed a bit grumpy. He was always working on the radio and TV sets and other appliances that surrounded his cot in the living room. He didn't like me very much. He thought I was a very bad influence on Maria, that I was trying to de-Russianize her.
Friendships. Рыча ему фрибеге медурайс не сядучи. Фрагу песня ты бы так грустно, раз и не беге тирайф. Саке кидай фай, могу ты пропепи мегай, но снеги кидай роки. Рай бы все снеги, хамадай.
It was so incredible. They invited me over for dinner, and I think he kind of forgave me for Maria painting everything in the house red, white, blue, and yellow. I mean, I loved real wood. We only had thin wood panels that my father never even really hung up on the wall properly.
Not very attractive. Arribiznorai.
And her grandmother made borscht with real vegetables, not the olive green kind that we used to get in cans. And they played Stravinsky and Rachmaninoff, and they served caviar, and they were a whole lot different than the other Russians I knew who were Jewish. There was so much quiet in the place. And it was so good that I had a little something to show them. I mean, I learned the troika in sixth grade.
And I remember going to St. Fortunata's church. I sat down in a pew and wondered if anybody knew I was Jewish. I loved to watch people going into those little confession booths. They looked so romantic with all the velvet and wood. Two booths, and Father Spina went to the one on the right, and Father Hart was in the left one. There were no psychiatrists or anything at that time, and I had a lot to confess, but I couldn't go in. I had to just sit there. You know, Frank Doretta was really cute. But he hated Jews, and my father had blonde hair and blue eyes and big muscles. One day I told him he was Irish, and he believed me, too, for a while.
Hey, Shell, so your old man's Irish, huh? You want to go to a movie or something?
The Jewish people in the projects, they look so tiny there in between all the big buildings. They used to crawl out of there to go to synagogue on the high holy holidays. Ah, it was such a beautiful song the Kenta was singing. To sit downstairs with the men with the nice silk shawls they had. But we had to sit upstairs. We had to sit upstairs. You know, the projects, there is now. There used to be a big, beautiful synagogue with marble. I thought stone was forever.
Aunt Clara owned a plastic flower company, and she decided to loan our family some money so that we could buy a house.
At first we looked in Long Island at one family houses with attics and willow trees in the front and flowered wallpaper. But she decided it would be a whole lot better to get a two-family house so that we could bring in a little income. Will we find a place only two blocks away at 625 Hemlock Street? We had upstairs neighbors, Seal Snipper with her bright orange beehive and her high heels. She looked like 17, but she was really 57. It was a lovely day when we moved to the house at 625 Hemlock Street. When we first moved there, the backyard looked like a forest. There were so many trees. But Dad found some marble slabs at a building site where he worked. And so he decided to rip out all the trees, which he thought were weeds anyway, and lay the slabs in. Dad was in the salvage business. They'd buy up soon-to-be-demolished buildings and rip everything out, and he'd bring lots of things home with him. One time he brought home thousands of bricks, and he built a brick wall in the basement and huge brick flower cases that he filled with sand and all the plastic flowers from Aunt Clara's company. Another time he brought home 400 boxes of slightly water-damaged Christmas lights that we never did get around to selling. Mom got a job working as a switchboard operator at the Misty Lingerie Company. She'd come home really tired at night, and she'd lie down in her bed with her card tray over her lap and her big bottle of Pepsi-Cola on the nightstand and her potato chips and cigarettes. She played solitaire, and she read Henry Miller novels. I'd serve her lamb chops. She liked them really well done so she could chew around the bone. And we'd talk about what happened to each of us that day. She'd tell me about someone that thought she was really articulate, and she never did finish high school. Neither did Dad. One time, I got to have the basement as my very own apartment. It was some kind of birthday present. I'd invite my friends over for dancing sessions. One day I was lying down in the storage room on a pile of old clothes and old furs and old fabrics, and I found a suitcase. I looked inside and there was a picture of Dad and some red-haired woman who I have never seen before, and a little boy, and a copy of Last Exit to Brooklyn.
Hey, whoa. You got a lot of guys on the block. You got Vinny Russo and the Crescent Gang. Man, if you're black and you walk down that street, they're gonna fucking kick your ass. They're gonna fucking kill you, man. You're really hip. And they thought I was pretty weird, too. Yeah.
Coming home on the train late at night. I was so scared, just like I am nowadays. I thought I was supposed to be at a safe age, but no such luck. The same kind of things are running through my head now that was running through it then. I promise you won't get your face sliced like the last guy that came. He told me he was from a group out in Ohio called the Music Explosion, and I believed him because the only thing I knew about Ohio was that there were some bubblegum groups out there. But then he came, and they ripped his face right open.
I promise it won't.
won't happen to you.
Franklin K. Lane High School, surrounded by a cemetery. Half of it is situated in South Ozone Park, Queens, and the other half in East New York, Brooklyn. I'd gone to school in Manhattan for a year, and there were only 500 students in that school, but I had decided I wanted to go a little closer to home. When I went to Franklin K. Lane, there were 5,000 kids in the school, and I was separated from the kids that I had known in junior high before. I went into the late shift with a lot of kids that they were bussing in from other parts of Brooklyn. When I first came around, I was wearing my fancy city clothes. My squirrel coat and my little mini dresses and the shoelaces matched the bow on my hat. And I'd wear berets, and the black girls called me Bonnie. And hey, Bonnie, where's Clyde, they'd always say. And it was the time of the Vietnam War, and a lot of teachers taught there so that they didn't have to go. Pretty soon I stopped wearing my Twiggy-like clothing and put on blue jeans. Mr. Tannenbaum, who was an English teacher, used to invite me down to his class to teach protest songs to the other kids. And we were the first school to hold the African flag up in the classroom. I tried to join the Afro-American club, but no, 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 you're white, you're white, you're white. One time, thousands of guys from Boys High came down from the elevated trains with bottles in their hands. There was rioting, rioting, rioting. Irish Schwartz wore a black beret and he looked like Che Guevara, except he had blonde, kinky hair. He lived in Cypress Hills Projects. He wore military boots and he turned me on to Marx and Engels. We started going up to SDS meetings at Columbia University. The kids in the high ceiling department where the meetings took place looked a lot like us, but they were different. Bourgeoisie! Bourgeoisie! Bourgeois! One night, I invited Ira Schwartz home with me. We took the A train to the last stop in Brooklyn. And when he came into my house, he unzipped his pants and pulled out his cock. Not very political. I turned on the light and troops of cockroaches came out of the dining room table. Dad worked in a very dirty place and he brought the cockroaches home with him, but he wouldn't take any responsibility for it. He'd always yell at Mom whenever he saw a cockroach. Dad, he was gone a lot now. He was drinking a lot now. Mom was home alone now. Dad, the same guy who always brought his black friends home with him, even when guys on the block would say, "You don't bring that guy around here," he would say, "You don't mess with me. I'll bring home whoever I like." Dad, he was singing a whole other song now. And when he learned that I was going up to SDS meetings, he said, "What are you? A communist? Communist? Communist?" Dad, the guy that thought Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the best president we ever had.
Those people on welfare! They should get a job! They should work! I worked my ass off and I still came home and danced with you!
Dad, the same guy who built solar systems with me on the bottoms of a lazy Susan. Turn, turn. Turn.
Communist! I want respect! I worked and I want respect!
We got a bomb!
We got a bomb! We got a bomb! Vietnam! Communist! Communist! Those people should get a job! Get a job!
Dad, the same guy. The very same guy. Living by the elevated trains, Marcia Calabro's window looked out right onto the tracks. She could practically touch the trains as they went by. Marcia Calabro. The first time I saw her,
was in the school auditorium at Franklin K. Lane High School. She was standing on a ladder with one thick leg extended really high. She was dancing to Bach. And when Marcia spoke English, she talked like this. But when she spoke French, Spanish, her old mouth, her old body, everything was totally different. Her parents were always screaming, Marcia! They had to speak really loud. They lived by the elevated trains. They owned a building that had 6 apartments in it. But they would always be collecting things, and when one family moved out, they would fill it up with objects so that they couldn't rent it out anymore. Marcia had her own apartment on the 2nd floor. And she'd sit in the window and rub rosemary oil on her hair and wrap a big turban around it, watching the trains go by, listening to the music they made. It was music to her, because she loved to love things. Sitting in the window with a guitar, and she sang like Joan Baez. And she read Rambo, and she read Soul on Ice, and she read Krishnamurti. And she could pick up a rock or anything and find the best light on it. And when she moved out with the Medina brothers, Jose and Eduardo, the basketball stars at Franklin K. Lane High School, her place became filled up with objects too, so that she couldn't move back in anymore. But then she moved to Spain. She became a flamenco dancer and moved in with a Spanish architect, moved in with his wife to learn the ways of another kind. She was blind, she saw just what she wanted to see. Then she became a Jew for Jesus, even though her name was Calabro, half Roman Catholic. She searched to find something that she could believe in, something she really could believe in, something of truth that she could believe in. And she taught me a lot. We'd walk under the tracks and talk about being women. Her eyes did glow. Married to her 2nd rabbi husband. I went to the 1st wedding, and I talk to her sometimes, and I find that her mind is still going in the same direction, 'cause she still loves, she still loves, she still
East New York. I don't live there anymore. But I went back recently, and I saw a lot of abandoned buildings. But there were churches with hand-painted signs in almost every other one. Went past the building I lived in until I was 3 years old, and some beautiful little kids were playing out front with sticks. It was all boarded up. And I told the little kids that I used to live there, and they said, "Yeah? Why'd you move out?" I said, What's going on here now? Why is it all boarded up?
Well, they was dealing a lot of drugs here, so they closed it up.
Down the road, we went to the synagogue where I used to go. It's now a Baptist church. And there was a beautiful pastor woman that was talking about repainting and fixing the chandeliers, keeping it basically the same. They also had a little daycare center in the basement. 544 Hemlock Street. Whole different kind of music playing in the hallways now. Real Spanish music, not the kind we used to listen to on Reader's Digest collection of music from the world. Down the street at 625 Hemlock Street, some kids were sitting on the stoop. I asked this one girl questions about the basement, and she looked at me like I was really weird. She told me she wanted to be an actress. No white people living there anymore. There used to be swamps at the end of East New York, but now there were all these big high-rise buildings. Went to Franklin K. Lane, too, but now it's a school officially in Queens, and I found out that it was the alma mater of John Gotti. Went to Marcia Calabro's house, and her family still live in there under the elevated trains, but all the families that they'd rented to had moved out, and they'd filled up all the places with their stuff. When I told Mrs. Calabro that I was doing a piece about the neighborhood, and when I started telling her about all the things that I remembered, she said to me, "How do you remember all these things? How do you remember? How do you remember?"
That was O Little Town of East New York, written, performed, and produced by Shelley Hirsch, with music by Shelley Hirsch and David Weinstein. O Little Town of East New York is a commission of the 1992 New American Radio Series.
You just heard O Little Town of East New York by Shelley Hirsch, broadcast by New American Radio.
Wow! What a graduation!
I'll say!
But with college behind us, we'll need careers, and good ones.
What about chestnut roasting? People always need chestnuts.
Or begging. I know a place that'll saw your legs off.
Slow down, fellas. I've got a way we can keep our legs and still have a bright future.
Now you're dreaming.
Oh, am I?
Of course! Nuclear power!
It's the job of tomorrow. Today!
Really?
Well, that settles it. For all those reasons and more, let us choose an electrifying career in nuclear power.